Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, on the heels of Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday, we dedicate the hour to music and politics. First, Serge Tankian joins us to talk about music, society, and inspiration. Then, musicians in danger, oppressed, silenced, and jailed all over the world. And finally, on the Scholar Circle, how music affects political change and how politics affects music. Serge Tankian is with us live in studio. He's a multi-platinum-selling musician, poet, and lead singer of the band System of a Down. His latest CD just came out, titled Harakiri. Harakiri is the Japanese word for a ritualistic suicide. Welcome, Serge Tankian.
Thank you, Maria.
Thinking about this latest CD, and it seems this CD is the most directly a statement. You've been a little more subtle before.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted that?
I think part of that answer is all the upheaval that's been happening around the world in the last number of years. It's been a lot more urgent. I think the music's become more urgent in some ways. Last year, beginning of the year, we were experiencing the massive deaths of bird and fish around the planet. And that to me was really ominous, really kind of biblical almost. It really affected me. And so the first song that I wrote for this record was the title track Harakiri. And that's why I decided to call it that. The song was a way of kind of understanding the symbolic nature of that disappearance of bird and fish. Why would they leave the planet? Such intuitive beings that were so well connected with the environment, early warning systems better than our own. Why would they go? What does that mean for environmental devastation, possible lack of food? So many different things to think about. And that was a month before the Japanese nuclear disaster. And it's been tumultuous couple of years, and I think the music has that urgency, the environmental undertones, as well as all of the economic inequities and the Occupy movement and everything else happening around the world, Euro crisis, Arab Spring, all of this plays into the vibe of the record.
You mentioned the harakiri. That is the Japanese phrase meaning suicide, mm-hmm. right? It's a suicidal ritual.
That's correct.
It's almost as if you're being the early warning sign.
Could be. I like the title, Harakiri, number one, because suicide has become so, the word itself in English is not as heavy and respectful as harakiri. And it's also a great symbolic kind of phrase for what we're doing to our planet. We're literally killing ourselves unconsciously on this planet with our waste, with the way that we're dealing with the planet. So that's also the bigger statement, the general statement of the record.
So you mentioned the birds and the fish. Of course, there have been the bees.
The bees,
massive
yep.
amounts of deaths
dying
in
off.
The bees,
mm-hmm.
massive just biodiversity just going away.
Yep.
We've seen just this year the floods, the fires, the extreme weather, and...
Absolutely. I just did a piece for Huffington Post talking about this, kind of stemming from the birds and fish, and then talking about environmental devastation and how I'm starting to feel like more of our political drama and more of our economical upheaval is going to start happening from ecological kind of stimuli. A good example that I always give is lack of rainfall in equatorial sub-Saharan, especially countries, is driving migration north. That northern migration will continue to persist as immigration problems for Europe, for example, pushing the political character of the countries a bit more toward the right, which we've seen in the last 5-10 years. Now, again, this is an ecological thing pushing into a political thing, causing possible turbulence in terms of human interaction. So there's going to be a lot more of these happening because we're seeing an accelerated rate of kind of destruction on the planet in terms of ecological disasters.
Right. That's what I think they call the climate refugees that you're talking
exactly,
about.
Yeah.
The other things you railed against in your songs, the occupation. I'm guessing that you were being specific about the occupation, Palestine.
Mm-hmm. You want to be as non-specific as possible as an artist and as a lyricist so that people can kind of internalize the meanings for themselves with all the songs. The song does use the word two-state solution, so it does kind of narrow in specifically with Israel and Palestine. And the song simply shows the hypocrisy of a victim turning into a victimizer. It talks about the need for a two-state solution. The middle eight part is really beautiful. It's this jazz breakdown that kind of goes through this moment of a mother putting a child to bed without having to worry about bombs falling overhead, as Israeli citizens have been worried about for a number of years with rockets coming from Hamas and etc. But at the same time, it talks about the occupation. And it talks about, my favorite line is, Holocaust, you've tasted great fear. How could you just occupy another child's tear? So it's a very moving song, and people are gravitating toward it because of it. We have a beautiful video that my friend Eric Nazarian made that's animation, and it doesn't talk about what country, but it really evokes many emotions, and following a girl and a bird kind of flying through this war-torn territory, and very sad but very beautiful.
And then you rail against the CEOs. You're very blatant about the CEOs.
Yeah. The song Figure It Out is very much a political satire. The complexities of the economic systems that we've had, the globalist system and the cracks that we're experiencing in it, and how people are rebelling against falling through those cracks and realizing the inequities in these kind of abusive capitalist systems and reacting to it. That's hard to do in a song, lyrically. So we decided to make it comical, and these CEOs that we all know have gotten away with murder because what they did was technically not illegal, but immoral nonetheless. So we go, let's just go get them in the song. So it became CEOs are the disease. Let's get them.
Are you going to be on Jon Stewart soon to do this? Oh, no, it would be Stephen Colbert would be the
Colbert,
more satirical.
Yeah, I'd love. Yeah, I like his show a lot. I'd be honored. Yeah.
And then, of course, reality TV and the whole idea of, you know, to make a democracy work, you need people who can really think things through and be critical thinkers. Mm-hmm. And you've kind of railed against that, too.
Yeah. Reality TV is a good verbal tongue-lashing of the decrepit common denominator society of that television genre. And it doesn't really poke fun at as much the actors and the productions, but our kind of voyeurism at wanting to watch those kind of things. Have our lives become so unreal that we have to watch someone else's supposed reality, knowing that it's not really their reality because it's all dramatized as well. Uneducated Democracy is another song on the record, and it basically talks about a democracy that can easily be kidnapped. The ideals of that democracy can be kidnapped to take the people into an unnecessary war, unnecessary occupation, unnecessary something that's against not just the will, but the interest of that democracy because of a lack of education on the part of that democracy. The Bush years are a great example of going into Iraq on the premise that there's WMDs and there's nuclear weapons ties with Al-Qaeda, none of which existed. Debacle happening with Iran right now and kind of motivating the American public to
support killing.
Again, if the American public was educated about Iran and our geopolitical dealings with the country in the last century, we would first have to apologize to them for overthrowing their government in the 1950s, a democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh that we overthrew and brought in a king. Again, it's about education. We're number 30 as a nation in education, number one in military, one in economy. That's dangerous in my book.
Musically, you've experimented a little bit differently this time.
I like using the electronic model of creating music to create authentic original music. So I would take my own loops from the previous records, reverse them, use the drum beats, and kind of set up stuff on the computer so that I can basically do it almost like an electronic track, but it would be a rock song. I also use the iPad. There's a lot of great music applications on the iPad just to play around with for fun. I would be playing around with them. I ended up sketching three of the songs using the iPad from the record and then play live instruments over. I also created my own iPad app.
A Serge app?
Yeah, it's called I Am Serge.
Is it really?
It is.
That's hilarious.
Well, it's based on the Savage Apps, who's the developer. They have a series of programs called I Am Beatbox, I Am Symphony, I Am Jazz, etc. It's so cool. It's really great because it utilizes all the loops from the records. It even has vocals. It's a very unique app, and you can create your own music, make ringtones, post to Facebook, etc. It's a great toy.
So let me remind listeners that we're speaking with Serge Tankian. He's a musician. He's a solo artist. He's also been the front man for System of a Down. He's a poet, and he's done rock musicals. We should talk about some of these other ventures.
Sure.
You just put out another poetry book. You've got two.
Yes.
And you've done a rock musical.
Yes. Early last year, we did Prometheus Bound, which is a rock musical with the American Repertory Theater. Prometheus Bound, as we all know, is the first Greek play. It's about the god Prometheus, who gave humanity fire and got punished by Zeus to be banished at the edge of the earth till eternity. It was actually great fun working with Steven Sater, who had done Spring Awakening and all these other amazing musicals, and Diane Paulus, who's a phenomenal director, and we ran 5 weeks there. So now we're trying to take that to New York and restart it up to to do something there. In March of last year, I released Glaring Through Oblivion, my second poetry book, and the artwork was done by a good friend of mine, Roger Kupelian, who's a phenomenal digital artist. A lot of stuff going on. I've got three other records I finished this year, actually, a jazz record, my first symphony called Orca.
Is it a Serge Tankian jazz record?
No. It's called Jazz is Christ. I made it with three
other... That is hilarious. Yeah. I know. How do you spell it?
Jazz-IZ-Christ. I figured, and this was the best way to get back at jazz purists and right-wing Christians at the same time, simultaneously. Then I did a symphony called Orca that I finished that's unreleased as well, that we're going to do a live orchestra so that we can put that out in that way.
Your life is full of all these creative endeavors. You're one of these musicians who not only makes great art, but you make great statement, great moving statement. And your life also reflects the issues that you care about and that you stand for. You've worked with Amnesty International. You've worked on the Armenian cause. You've worked with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You've worked with environmental organizations. I think I saw recently that you did something in Santa Monica against the law prohibiting feeding homeless people. There's so many issues. Yeah. How do you choose what to support and how do you work that into your creative career?
That's a good question. There are a lot of issues. There's a lot of causes and your heart goes out to a lot of different things, but you can only physically work on so many things. So you have to choose. And whatever matches up with what you do best, I think you have to always look at your skills and where would I be best effective and where does my heart tell me that I need to go right now, that kind of a thing. I would say that my Axis of Justice co-host Tom Morello is much better at myself than kind of throwing himself even further around and supporting so many incredible causes. And he works so hard that it makes me feel lazy.
Well, you can't feel lazy with what you're doing, but he's definitely extraordinarily active, no doubt about that.
He's incredible.
One of the things that I've followed your career with is the Armenian Genocide Resolution and trying to get official recognition for the Armenian Genocide. Mm-hmm. And both of our grandparents were survivors. One of the things you said at a conference is that your Turkish fans have been very receptive.
Mm-hmm.
What has that experience been? How do you feel like that's making any impact, if it is, in Turkey?
I'm not sure I have enough data about the impact. However, a couple of years back, there was some disinformation planted in the Turkish press, I assume by the government or by the, what is it called, the deep state. And there was all this complete falsifications about System of a Down, printing rhetoric on tickets that were against Turks or burning Turkish flags and all this stuff, none of which have ever occurred during any of our tours, nor any of our tours with Slayer when we first went out. So they were complete fabrications to kind of turn our fans against us in Turkey, which I thought was really interesting that they would go that far. And so we just simply posted something on our website saying to our fans, these are all lies and they're just trying to turn our fans in Turkey against us. Obviously, we don't know why. Obviously, it's because our message having to do with awareness of the Armenian genocide is hitting a bone and making an impact. So that's all we did. Technically, that was our reaction. We didn't go to press with it. We didn't go to Turkish press, which maybe that's what they wanted us to do. I'm not sure. But we found out in time that our fans were actually contacting each of those news agencies, papers, basically saying that this is all falsification. Here's the band's website. We have those tickets. We've gone to one of the shows in Germany, or because, you know, you can't create information in a vacuum. And so they stood up for us. And we thought, wow, this is incredible. And we've never even played in Turkey because it's been difficult for my band, myself, to play in a country where you can't express yourself freely without incarceration or any of that.
That's,
you know,
one of the issues we're covering today is the Turkish government oppressing so many musicians, particularly on the Kurdish question.
Yeah, definitely.
So that leads me to kind of the big, broad question that we're doing in the whole hour, which is this interaction between music and society and politics, whether art itself is always a political statement and what that interaction can be, should be. You've been far more active than most other musicians, you and Tom. How do you see this relationship?
Music is an intuitive medium. I think there's nothing wrong with just dance music and making people move and have a good time and getting those positive vibes in the body going. And, you know, it's a tribal type of ceremony, music. So music itself, for entertainment purposes, is great. I think it serves an awesome function. But I think it also is important as a narrative concept. and in terms of reflecting the times that we live in, talking about some of the truths that permeate through society that connect us all. The muse, in my opinion, is the inspiration that comes from that collective consciousness for us to be able to kind of gather like rain and be able to present. If we present it skillfully, we're known as good musicians.
So it's really speaking to music as an experience of depth, like humanity is almost music diplomacy in a way.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah.
The new record is called Harakiri, and it just came out.
Yes.
Just last week, right? Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's the title track.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings, streaming down from the higher seas. Deflected by the ground, they crown the sun, they crown the sun.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the intersection of music and politics. In many cases, music affects political change, but also musicians are affected by politics, sometimes banned, censored, jailed, and sometimes even killed. We're joined by Uli Reithoff, who's the program manager for Free Muse, an organization that seeks to protect musicians and artful expression. And we also have with us Michael O'Reilly, who is senior campaign director for Individuals at Risk at Amnesty International. Let me welcome the two of you. I wanted to take a look at some of the situations around the world now. Michael O'Reilly, I thought maybe we could start with you, particularly because of the journalists who were jailed for listening to hip-hop. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. You're referring to cases of the journalists who were brothers, Antonio Michel Lima Cruz.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Marcos Michael Lima Cruz. They were arrested in Cuba in 2010 on Christmas Day, during a celebration of Christmas Day. They took it outside into the streets, were listening to music of a dissident rap group, is kind of an underground band in Cuba, and were arrested and charged for disturbing the peace.
So it wasn't specifically related to the music so much as it was that they were listening to it outside, or so it seemed.
Right, but it's the music itself. People listen to music inside and outside all the time in Cuba. It's both the music and the individuals themselves. I think that the important thing with music is that musicians are part of a larger society. So music is a form of freedom of expression. The places where we see musicians at risk of being detained, at risk of being harassed or threatened because of their work, these are countries that tend to also clamp down on freedom of expression of all forms. And that certainly has been true in Cuba. And so these brothers previously had some interactions with the Cuban government. And the band that they were listening to is also one that was not exactly a favorite of the Cuban authorities.
Uli Reithoff, let's bring you in. You're the program manager for Free Muse, which actually fights for freedom of expression for artists and others like that. You've also been working on several cases or bringing light to several cases where musicians are being oppressed. One was in Cameroon, one is in Kabul, one is in Turkey. Tell us about these.
Well, the case in Cameroon is probably the longest case we've been working on. We were working on the case for 3 years. The singer and musician, Lapira de Mabango, wrote a song which criticized the president for continuing being in office. It was actually called Constipated Constitution, and the government set up charges against him which were completely false. But as you know, it is quite complicated to get into all court details, and not before we were able to collaborate with a group of international lawyers and put the case in front of the UN, the Commission on Arbitrary Detention, we finally got some results. In the meantime, of course, Lapierre was in prison. An organization like Free Muse can do campaigns. We can support the family financially. This was typical of a political case where a government tries to silence a musician because of criticism. Now, in Turkey, the situation is very severe for artists in general these days. A lot of intellectuals and artists are sentenced to prison. Others are taken in front of courts, endless court cases. We worked with Ferhat Tunç, who is promoting the idea of the rights of the Kurdish minorities. And Ferhat Tunç has been in court cases for the past 10 years. And some of these charges are very serious charges because the Turkish government tend to put them in the category of terrorist activities. And that's a very serious thing in Turkey. So he is a person who fights for minority rights. That's another example of repression of musicians and composers worldwide. And of course, you have a lot of religious censorship. The worst we know in history was probably when the Taliban had power in Afghanistan and all music was banned. But you still see the long-term effects of that in Afghanistan. It's still not safe to play everywhere. And in the neighboring country, Pakistan, we still see killings of musicians, not imprisonments, but simply killings which are motivated by religious beliefs.
Is it a religious belief about music itself, or is it religious beliefs about the message in the music?
Well, there's a lot of confusion about music, especially in the world of Islam, unfortunately. On one level, there's a very strong traditions in general of music in Muslim countries for hundreds of years. But the new radical interpretation of Islam, the so-called Wahhabi interpretation, has a belief that music is completely unacceptable. And this means that in those areas of the world where this Wahhabi-inspired ideology, which comes out from Saudi Arabia, which we should always be remembering, Saudi Arabia is still supported by the West. But in spite of that, we have this really fundamentalist attitude coming out. And so there's been very strong attacks from Wahhabi-influenced people in Somalia, in Nigeria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, so on and so forth. Then, of course, you have Iran as a special case where women are completely banned for performing live. So there are a lot of different categories in terms of how music is persecuted or even prosecuted.
We've also seen, courtesy of Amnesty International, Michael O'Reilly, your organization, about some oppression in Russia. What is happening there?
It's actually pretty astonishing to see the crackdown in Russia, both in the lead-up to the presidential elections that brought Vladimir Putin back into power and in the time since he has become president. And I think the case that you're referring to is the young feminist punk group called Pussy Riot. And this is a collective of young women who have used performance art, music, as a platform for expressing their political views, and they've been very vocal in objecting to the change in the constitution of Russia that allowed Putin to come back in and serve as president again. And they've used this technique of having quick kind of flash concerts in strange settings, in the middle of a square, on top of a bus, on top of a detention facility in Moscow. They would sing songs dressed up in colorful outfits wearing face masks so that they can't be identified by authorities, and then disperse before they can be grabbed. In February, they did this at a cathedral in Moscow, and they performed their song, Virgin Mary, Deliver Us from Putin. They were escorted out of the church by authorities at the time. They were not arrested at the time. It was only weeks later that the police came and arrested three of the women and have been holding them since that time on charges of hooliganism, which could carry a sentence of up to 7 years if they're convicted.
These are very blatant forms of oppression. What it is exactly that governments are afraid of? This is a form of art. Sometimes it's clearly a protest song, but you know, people in the streets, I'm sure, are saying similar things. So there must be something that the authorities are afraid of.
In general, I suppose you could say that music somehow transcends ages and countries and social groups. The thing about music and lyrics is that you can actually stop the performers, but you cannot stop the songs. And if you look at America during the civil rights movement, songs were always very strong part of the movement. And this is a global phenomenon, and that's what authorities in general are afraid of, that you can make use of songs as social commentary and people will somehow remember those songs.
Michael O'Reilly?
Oh, I absolutely agree with what Oli said, and I think that song is a powerful factor in social movements throughout history. If we look at, in the United States, Joan Baez, to take an example, Joan Baez was arrested many times for protesting the Vietnam War. She stood with the farm workers. She's a lifelong human rights activist. She was actually one of the founders of Amnesty International in the United States. She had counterparts in other countries, Victor Jara in Chile, the Plastic People in Czechoslovakia, Fela Kuti in Nigeria, you know, and Fela's music spoke about the repression that the people of Nigeria were feeling from the military government at the time, and he was perceived as dangerous because of that. And I think that that lies at the core here. It's that people who are willing to speak truth to power or sing truth to power provoke a fear on the part of some authorities that are trying to clamp down. And that's why you see in Angola, which is led by a president who's been in power now for over 30 years. It's interesting, you're seeing a number of rappers who have been targeted by authority forces. These are very politically aware young rap artists who are using music to deliver their political views, and that's perceived as a threat to the authorities.
And rap music actually is the leading force in social commentary worldwide. The interesting thing about rap music is that it's been adopted by all local cultures. In Senegal, rap musicians have played a very central role in the political movements. The reason why a rapper is arrested now in Morocco is that he was criticizing corruption. The idea of rap music outside the U.S. is not the bling-bling rap, but actually social commentary.
There is this hard kind of oppression that we're seeing and that we're talking about now, but it seems there's also soft oppression, like what might be occurring in the U.S. with the consolidation of all the record companies and radio stations, so that there's only a particular kind of music that people hear, a very kind of corporate-friendly kind of music. Is that a concern at all?
It is indeed, and it's been a concern for a long time. I think since the parental advisory stickers were adopted by the industry itself, and when Walmart rejected having any albums. From the outside world, it's quite interesting to look at the U.S. in the sense that you can walk into Walmart and you can buy a weapon, but you cannot buy a CD with a sticker saying parental advisory. That's kind of a dilemma. And the vertical integration of publishing companies, production companies, and so on and so forth, really is, in a way, a threat to what you would normally call cultural diversity. Now, again, outside the U.S. and maybe especially in Europe and Africa and Asia, the whole idea of cultural diversity means that you have access to various kinds of music, theater, literature. As you probably know, the UNESCO Convention on the Promotion of the Expressions of Cultural Diversity was not signed by the U.S. It was signed by most of the world because there is an interest from the big industries to control the rest of the world. So it is a big concern.
Michael O'Reilly?
I think this goes back to the point that Oli was making earlier about perception of music from different cultures in Turkey, in Afghanistan. Music is an expression of one's culture. And in that respect, it needs to find avenues. I think that it will find avenues for expression. And that's the wonderful thing about music, is that you can never fully repress music. You may have fewer and fewer record companies and therefore fewer and fewer avenues through that means. But of course, then we've also got the internet, which opens up new doors. As governments try to close one door, other ones open.
Well, wonderful. Thank you both for being with us. Oli Reitoff, Michael O'Reilly, thank you so much. More music and politics on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned.
It's time to go up to bed. No more sipping on our regret. Tuck the kids in without worry.
welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. All over the world and throughout history, music has been a vital part of affecting social and political change. At times, the powers that be resist that change by oppressing music and the arts. How has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? We're joined by three experts. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. He's also author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, and co-editor of the book series Refiguring American Music. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern History at University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Story of Islam's Generation X. Richard Flax is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Making History, The American Left and the American Mind, and Playing for Change, Music and Musicians in the Service of Social Movements. Dick Flax, I'm going to start with you to put this into a historic and political context with Woody Guthrie and also his fellow cohort of artists and how they have helped to shape American politics as we have it today.
Well, I would say more specifically, helped to shape American dissent or protest politics, social movements. That was the goal that Woody Guthrie and his colleagues, if you want to call them that, in the early years of the 1940s, late 1930s, set out to do. They had a project, which I think Woody, among others, described as taking traditional music rather than the popular mainstream music of the day and putting lyrics to that music that would deal with contemporary issues, and particularly in their day, the labor movement. And I think when you learn about them, then you can possibly think back for decades, back to the 19th century. The labor movement in this country, as well as other places, always had a strong musical dimension to it. And Woody and his people like Pete Seeger and others picked up that thread and tried to revitalize that at the time that I'm referring to. I think, though, that the main impact of that project politically really was in the 60s by what's been called the children and grandchildren of Woody Guthrie, Dylan most famously, who introduced this form of musical expression just when the mass movements of the 60s were emerging and helped to shape particularly the student movement, the youth revolt, the anti-war movement of the 60s through the songs that provide a shared identity, I think, for what ended up being millions of people, really.
So we have a shared identity. And then, Josh Kuhn, maybe this is the perfect place to bring you in, because you've looked at U.S. musical history as being intertwined with the history of race and ethnicity and identity. How do you see this interacting?
Well, I think that if you go back and you even just start with the very kind of foundations of the notion of America itself, the very kind of mythical promise of a democratic America, we see that song and music have long been central to debates around that. And the most obvious place to look there, of course, is in the music of slaves and in the sorrow songs of newly arrived Africans and African Americans in the United States, where music might not have sounded political, might not have announced itself as a protest song in the way that as we just heard in the 1960s, it really took shape in that way. But in the early days, of course, when we're talking about sorrow songs and slave songs, you're talking about music that had codes, music that didn't announce itself as overtly protest or oppositional, but served a political function. And I think throughout the history of the very notion of America, the history of the United States itself, music has always been a site for struggle around the meanings of freedom and liberty. And that's still the case to this very day.
Mark Levine, you've argued in your work that music is a better way of understanding culture and societies, particularly in the Middle East, than are many other means. Why do you say that?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, music is one of the oldest and most profound cultural expressions, and so many other aspects of culture come through it. So, for example, prayer and religious performance is very often traditionally expressed musically. Certainly, in the Middle East, there's a very old tradition of protest poetry and then music, going back at least into the 30s, 40s, 50s. You see this naturally in the protests, whether in Tahrir Square in Cairo or in Abu Dhabi, and so much music just naturally exploding from there, or in Tunisia, or in Syria, where at least one of the major poet singers there was brutally murdered. And in Morocco right now, another one is in jail, you know, on potentially trumped-up politicized charges, a rapper. It's also a way of seeing commonalities. I think so much of the problem when Americans look at other cultures, especially the Middle East, where we have so many conflicts and so many misunderstandings, music is a way of seeing the commonalities between the struggles everyone shares. And I think when you see the, you know, really strong influence, let's say, the early 2010-11 revolts had on the Occupy movement in Europe and the U.S., you can see how, especially through music and through poetry and through this artistic expression, they were able to create solidarities between movements in different countries that otherwise would have been much harder to have.
You bring up another important point, which is the oppression of the arts as a means of maybe oppressing a certain kind of communication or a solidarity. Tell us a little bit about this oppression that you've seen.
I don't want to overemphasize, as some people have done, but one of the causal factors in the explosion of protests in Tunisia was the jailing of this one rapper, El General, who wrote a song called Rais Le Bled, President of the Country, where he was, you know, really just begging the president at that point, Ben Ali, to just understand the cost of his policies and his avarice and greed and violence on a generation. And when he was arrested, young people came out in even bigger numbers to protest his jailing. And that was the first symbol that you can use a music that is specifically related to the generation that's revolting as a means of communicating. You know, Chuck D, Public Enemy, famously said that hip-hop was the CNN of the street of Black America, essentially. And this is exactly what this music became in the Middle East, whether it was hip-hop or for 2 decades before that, music like heavy metal and other so-called Western genres, hardcore punk, were used by young people to express their anger and frustration at a system from which they were severely marginalized. And this has continued. If you look at Egypt, the quote-unquote singer of the revolution, Rami Hassan, was grabbed off the street and severely tortured by the Egyptian authorities in the wake of the Egyptian revolution when they next had protests, I think, last March of 2011. And just all across the board, wherever there's been these revolts in the Arab world of the last 2 years, musicians and also other types of artists have been at the forefront, and governments have gone after them because of that, because they understand that they're able to communicate in a means that the governments can't compete with. And they can reach people, especially with the internet, but also through live performances and bringing people together in a way that governments can't do. And I'll just give you one example from the last time I was in Egypt with Rami Hassan in April, I guess. He was performing at a major, major protest, tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square, and there was all this conflict between the Salafis, or the ultra-religious, and the secular forces. And when he came on the stage, he brought with him a huge number of these ultra-soccer fans who had been so crucial to the revolution, at least on the streets and the fighting. And they barreled through all the Salafis to establish a presence there. But once he started playing, you could see Salafis coming and sort of drifting over and listening to the music and nodding their head to his songs, because his songs ultimately were about freedom and against the government and reflected exactly what they were feeling. So even though from an Orthodox religious perspective they maybe should not have been listening to it, they couldn't help but listen to it. And for that moment at least, the Salafis and the ultras suddenly understood, and they were in the same space and seeing they had a common enemy, which was the government and the military. And that's precisely the kind of thing that music can do that almost no other art form can do.
Josh Kuhn, talk about what you've seen in Mexico.
In Mexico, in some ways similar to the things that Mark was describing in the Middle East, during this past election year, the growing student movement, Yo Soy 132, the Yo Soy 132 student movement, was a movement that actually, when it started, didn't have much music at its core, but gradually music became a central part of how students were organizing themselves and not only expressing their political views in opposition to the right-wing political parties in Mexico, but how they were actually using music as a way to figure out community, as a way to figure out what their ideas were. So I guess what I find really interesting is both how music can be a direct form of expression, as Mark was talking about it, but also can be the very kind of ground for the building of a community that allows that expression to happen. Throughout the past few months in Mexico, we've been seeing that all over the place, where music has been at marches, but also been a way for students to just have an excuse to get together, to write songs together, to formulate and rehearse ideas that then enter into a larger kind of public debate.
I can recall a time in Chile post-coup that the particular kind of music was banned, and yet people would sneak it on the air on the sly. But soft oppression that we've had here in the U.S. during the McCarthy era and even post-9/11, Dick Flax, could you speak to that?
Well, we do have some great stories of the martyrdom of troubadours in this country. One example before the time you're mentioning was Joe Hill, who was the sort of supreme songwriter of the industrial workers of the world, the wobbly revolutionary labor movement in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He was tried and executed for murder in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1915, a funeral with 100,000 people in Chicago after his execution. The big McCarthy moment people remember in terms of music was Pete Seeger. He was called before the Un-American Activities Committee. He was one of many entertainers, of course, who experienced that, but Pete took the stance that he would not respond to their questions because the government had no right to ask the questions. And that led to a contempt citation by Congress. He faced a year in jail, but he ultimately won his court case. But that certainly added to the definition of him as a figure of protest and a symbol of strong dissent during that particular period. I'm not sure that repression is the main story in the United States about the uses of music, but I think what we've heard already is that any time you have this kind of musical development, and particularly the emergence of sort of troubadours with a kind of heroic quality to them, they often become targets for the regime, and that move on the part of the regime that's feeling itself threatened can backfire badly. The big moment of supreme repression of music was the torture and execution of Victor Jara, the great troubadour of the Chilean protest in the early 70s. His death really has stayed as a kind of symbol for decades after that globally of the power of song, I guess, and of almost Christ-like figure that emerges from music in many, many parts of the world. It's quite amazing how troubadours can take on that symbolic value for large numbers of people. And the effort to suppress them, as has been said, is very dangerous because it's in the mass popular consciousness and a shared feeling that this music has reached. So when you start to repress it, people who might otherwise not be sure of their politics begin to see this as the true nature of the regime, the repression.
Josh Kuhn, you have looked at Gil Scott-Heron saying music being a melodic form of guerrilla warfare.
This was in the context of a kind of larger examination of the role of music in the Black Power movement. And what's interesting about that quote from Scott-Heron is he both was talking about songs that lyrically were staging a protest, but also just the way that, let's say, in an instrumental piece, I believe the original context for that was that when he was a young boy in music school, the idea that he would play classical music on a piano when his teacher wasn't in the room and make changes to the pieces that he was playing, that was his own form of protest. And so I think it's equally important, as Mark was signaling a bit earlier, that, you know, lyrics clearly are what we so often focus on with good reason, but also in instrumental songs, just the choice of style, Western pieces versus Eastern pieces, songs that sound quote-unquote too Black, too Mexican, too Jewish, songs that disrupt the kind of dominant sonic racial order. Throughout time, just the sound of something can be disruptive enough to cause protest, to cause debate, to cause change. And so I think part of what he was getting at there is that the choices that we make as listeners, the choices that we make as musicians, the music we choose to play and how we choose to play it are aesthetic choices that have social impact.
Mark Levine, let's bring you in on that. Is that what you're seeing also in these changing areas in the Middle East?
I think certainly music is helping to break down boundaries, absolutely. I guess we could also think of Fela Kuti, who said music is the weapon of the future. I think his last album was named that, and he was someone who knew a lot about regime oppression. They literally threw his mother out the window of his house and killed her because of his political activities. if people look at this organization, FreeMuse, a Danish organization that is basically the Amnesty International for musicians, it's amazing how many musicians around the world right now are suffering severely, whether censored, repression, torture, jail, or murdered, or assassinated for their activities and their music. What I think is clear is that music on its own can't do it, but it's very hard to spread revolution without a cultural marker that can grab people together. You know, music is not a sufficient condition. You know, you can have revolutionary music and not have the revolution. But it's hard to think of revolutions that didn't have some kind of musical component that wasn't just expressing what was already there, but expressing it in a way that amplified it. And I think great music does two things. It amplifies, so it takes what everyone is saying and it boils it down to the most powerful elements and then sends it out even louder. But it also is a kind of prism. It also refracts and breaks apart dominant ideologies and makes it easier to critique or to take what you already, you know, to use, let's say, the idea of Gramsci about common sense versus good sense. Great revolutionary music would take everyone's common sense and turn it into good sense, and that what everyone sort of knows will become something that they can trust their ears. Now, they can trust that what they're suspecting is true, but they can also act on it, and it gives you, you know, both hope and possibility. At least in the music I've been following in the Arab world the last 2 years, that's really what makes it so special. And I think when you look at Woody Guthrie, of course, or any of the great protest movement, Pete Seeger, or for that matter, Public Enemy, or even after 9/11, I think at one point there were over 100 hip-hop songs that have been written in protest against the post-9/11 militarization of American politics that, unless you were listening to KPFK or something, you probably didn't hear. But the artists were out there, and there were these sub-communities, and they were being heard. In all these places, there's still pockets where music is at the forefront and is carrying the torch, so to speak, to keep things lit. And again, I don't want to say that music is more powerful than, let's say, a play or a poem or a piece of graffiti. But out of all those, it's the only one that you can join in on, right? You can read a poem, but you're not going to join, but that's not a communal experience. You can go see a piece of graffiti. You can go see a play. You can watch a movie. You can read a book. But music's the only one where you can gather around with everyone and all do the art together. And that's what I think makes it a uniquely powerful medium for protesting and then transcending.
Dick Flax, let me add to that, because I think that's a very important point. There is something unique about singing as an art form, and I think you put your finger on a good part of it, the idea of gathering around. And as Seeger has tried to show, singing together is a very empowering experience. All religions know that, of course. National anthems sung together, but social movements. What I wanted to add was that it's a unique art form because you don't need an artist in a specialized sense to create or reproduce the song. The song becomes everybody's property. You can sing the song yourself without any talent or trained capacity as a musician. You keep it in your consciousness. It's part of your being in a way that I don't think there's any other art form that can quite do this. Yip Harburg, who was a great political Broadway lyricist, he said a song is the unique way in which thought and feeling are fused, which I think is another part of trying to define why this is a particularly important political means of expression. So it's the bringing together of people. It's the creation of some sense of empowerment when people are singing together. It's the combination of ideas and emotion in a fused way. And there are many different functions of particular songs. Some are these collective empowerments. Some are songs that have ideas that you, the creator of the song, are trying to convey to others. And there's therefore very complicated songs as well as very chant-like songs. One of the great protest songs was Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon. Great because everyone could sing it in mass rallies at the end of the war. Protest movement, millions of people were singing this together. So it was a brilliant invention by Lennon of the most simple idea of how a song can work for empowerment purposes.
This is Josh Kuhn. I think the idea of music as a mode of public gathering and of bringing people together to sing together, to join voices, to raise voices in unison is obviously a very, very important point. And I just want to add to that, though, is that there's also the other aspect, which is the non-public part of music, which is to say the power of being able to listen to a recording in private, in your bedroom, on headphones, actually outside of the public gaze, so that you can retreat to a kind of sense of private refuge, to use music as a way to imagine worlds that you didn't think were actually possible, or worlds that were actively being shut down in front of your very eyes and ears. So that, for me, part of what makes music so singularly special, I think, in many ways, as a political tool, is how it keys into a broader sense of what politics are. This idea that music can allow you to imagine worlds that you didn't think were otherwise going to be possible. And often we need to be alone and in private for that to happen.
A few other aspects of this that I think about in today's music world, particularly in the United States, and it's something that Mark Levine, you mentioned, which is oftentimes these really great music doesn't get heard, particularly in a consolidated radio world where there's not very much exploration of things that veer outside of what the establishment sees as commercial. And so I wonder if music can still play this role in the U.S. if they're A, not hearing some of this great music, but B, if they're misunderstanding some of it.
Dick Flex, I've been really preoccupied with that question for quite a while now. Radio is no longer the framework, even though I also have my own radio show, where most people, I think younger people particularly, are getting awareness of music. You just go to YouTube and look for certain musicians, you'd be quite amazed by how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have made hits on various things that you may not have heard in any other context. So I'm not sure we know all that much about how people are getting access to cultural forms, musical forms, song and performances now, but it's the opportunity for people to hear about this far transcends what radio was ever able to bring to people or what CDs are able to bring to people. And it's hard to even know what the channels of communication are among people, young people in particular, that lead them to find out about these kinds of things online and find them. But there are hundreds and hundreds of people writing songs now coming out of the Occupy movement. There just was a 4-CD album released with 99 Occupy songs. That's a lot of songs, but there's still more of them if you go to YouTube or other, just go online and look for them. I don't know what people who are producing these songs think their fate will be. It seems like people want to get their performances out there. It's cheap and technologically very feasible now to do it, so people are doing it. And whether a particular song is shared by a lot of people and known by a lot of people is one sort of question which may be hard to answer from this great Tower of Babel of music that is now out there. But certainly the creativity is happening, and I think when people are in mass protests like the Occupy types of protests, they're bound to be coming up with songs or sharing songs. And some of the major performers, Tom Morello is one of the best examples, has been going around a lot in the old Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger way to these rallies and singing and creating these songs that can be sung by people in that context.
I think that's a really great point, Mark Levine. And I think the sad part is Morello is one of the few people who's doing this on a regular basis. What's actually shocking to me in the U.S. context is how completely all these major supposedly liberal performers who, you know, will give, you know, do a benefit for Obama, you didn't see them in Wisconsin the way you'd see Morello and one or two other people. And that's something I think in America that's really sad, that how divorced even people like Springsteen and others who at one point were much more politically active have become from being out there with their music on the grassroots. They might do a big song like U2 might do a song about Iran when they had their protests after the 2009 election, but they're not doing anything that's actually putting themselves on the line.
Well, you know, I would like not to make such a sweeping generalization, because if you take Springsteen himself, not only did he put out his most political album, which is very related to the Occupy movement, but I've seen, if you go to YouTube and see some of his performances, they're very much embracing in these large mass concert venues, the movement.
Yeah. He
hasn't necessarily gone to
I certainly agree with you there, but I guess for me, coming from the Middle Eastern context, I think there's something crucial about being at the site.
Oh, I agree with that.
Creating the community there. Yes, absolutely agree. It's last, you know, very political, but I think it's very crucial for people to be with the people protesting because it brings more people down, and
yeah,
it helps create the numbers. And I'm not sure why, for the most part, most of the big name so-called liberal artists or progressive artists have not really made it a point of making Occupy their own, because had they done that, I think they would have helped sustain this movement after that initial burst inevitably was going to die down. And, you know, Morello can't be everywhere, right? And there needs to be other people. And just when you have musicians, for example, in Bahrain or in Morocco or others, when the musicians are willing to go out and sacrifice themselves either by being arrested or being on the front lines or being hosed down or even worse, beaten, this, in a way, really motivates so many other people to do the same thing. And somehow in America, we've been so far removed, even our musical elite, from being willing to do that, that it really makes it much harder for the music that we do have to have the kind of political impact that it might otherwise have, at least in my opinion.
I think that one other thing that's important to mention here, though, is, of course, if we look at the biggest civil rights marches in the history of the United States, which happened in 2006 and 2007, pro-immigration marches that gathered millions and millions and millions of people across the country, you saw bands marching. Now, these were bands that many people aren't talking about in the English-speaking world, but in the Spanish-speaking world of the United States, specifically in the context of Mexican immigration and Mexican migrancy in the United States, bands singing in Spanish, who are commercially popular bands, are at the same time on the front lines of these marches and are the musical voices of migrant Mexican America. And I think that it's really, really important when we're talking about America, in quotes, that we're also talking about and thinking about multilingual music here, and especially not leaving out the central role that Spanish language music is playing in the United States right now in shaping all kinds of debates around immigration and migrancy and all these other questions.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. And let me thank you all so much for this wonderful discussion. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern history at University of California, Irvine. Richard Flax is emeritus professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim, Carson DeZuris, who all contributed to today's show. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.